This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Here we enlighten you with ayahs 261 and 262 from the Surah Baqara, recited by Ali Parhiskar.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahirrahmanirrahim. مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم مثل الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل كمثل حبة أنبتت سبع سنابل في كل سنبلة مئة حبة والله يضاعف لمن يشاء والله واسع عليم الذين ينفقون أموالهم في سبيل الله ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى ثم لا يتبعون ما أنفقوا منا ولا أذى لهم أجرهم عند ربهم ولا خوف عليهم ولا هم يحزنون صدق الله العلي العظيم.
In the name of God, the most gracious, the most compassionate. The parable of those who spend their property in the way of Allah is as the parable of the grain growing 7 years, with 100 grains in every ear. And Allah multiplies for whom He pleases, and Allah is ample giving, knowing. As for those who spend their property in the way of Allah, then do not follow what they have spent with reproach or injury. They shall have their reward from their Lord, and they shall have no fear, nor shall they grieve.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
Iran's Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says the country's latest missile achievements can disable enemy's defense shields for many decades. Syria denounces the Human Rights Council's recent anti-Iran resolution, saying the West exploits international mechanisms for its own political goals. And Israeli forces kill a Palestinian man and injure nearly 24 more in an attack on a town near the West Bank city of Al-Khalil. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. A top commander of the Islamic Revolution Guards Corps says Iran has reached a significant level of deterrence in its military industries, including in the missile, drone, and air defense radar and space sectors. The comment was made by the head of the IRGC Aerospace Force Brigadier General Amir Ali Hajizadeh. The commander said that Iran's new achievements can disable the missile shields of its enemies, namely the U.S., Israel, and their vassal states for several decades. Hajizadeh said the IRGC Aerospace Force has created a path forward in the field of defense by relying on the country's domestic might and youthful human resources. The commander added that such advances can also help Iran in other fields, such as the economy. The Syrian foreign minister has slammed the UN's recent anti-Iran human rights resolution, saying the West is using international bodies as a tool to reach its own political goals. In a phone call with his Iranian counterpart, Faisal al-Mikdad, described the resolution as arbitrary and unacceptable. The Syrian foreign minister said the move is part of the ongoing Western measures against independent states in order to implement destructive agendas. He added that it represents a violation of the sovereignty of those states and their right to follow policies that suit the history and traditions of their people. Iran has strongly condemned the resolution by the UN Human Rights Council, which called for a probe into the country's riots that started in September. We talked to author and commentator John Stepling for his take on the recent anti-Iran resolution by the UN Human Rights Council and Tehran's reaction to it.
I think there's no reason at all for Iran to participate on any level with this, because it only serves to at least partly legitimize the process, and it's an illegitimate project. Iran has nothing to gain. I think they should sever all ties with the United States, I mean diplomatic ties, because I don't see the good that can come out of it at this point. The U.S. has sanctioned Iran. These are criminal sanctions. The United States sanctions almost everybody, but they have illegally sanctioned Iran. Iran agreed to the JCPOA, bent over backwards to meet all its requirements, and the United States tore it up anyway. The U.S. is very big on tearing up treaties and international agreements. Iran has done none of that, and yet they are constantly the object of this rhetorical abuse from the U.S., Israel, Saudi Arabia, European media. It's unbelievably biased, and it's very hard, I think, for the Western public to get an accurate picture of the situation vis-a-vis Iran, because much as it is impossible for the Western public to get a picture of Russia, because the reporting is so extraordinarily biased and one-sided.
Israeli forces have killed yet another Palestinian, this time near the occupied West Bank city of Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron. Israeli soldiers shot Mufid Al-Khalil in the head with live bullets after raiding the town of Beit Amra. The Palestinian Red Crescent says nearly two dozen others were also injured, nine of them with live rounds. Israel has been carrying out deadly attacks on Palestinian towns and cities in the West Bank almost on a daily basis. The regime forces have killed more than 200 Palestinians in Gaza and in the occupied West Bank since the beginning of this year. And we're also receiving some breaking news from the health ministry. Has announced that a young Palestinian has also been killed and his brother has been seriously injured by Israeli troops. Now, to discuss that further and get more details, we have our correspondent Mona Kandel joining us live from Ramallah. Mona, tell us more about these recent killings of a Palestinian youth by the Israeli forces and, of course, a very obvious intensified aggression towards Palestinians.
Let's start first with the urgent news. As you have mentioned, Israeli forces raided the town of Kfar Ayn. It's near Ramallah, and there were clashes between Palestinian residents of Kfar Ayn and the nearby villages with the Israeli soldiers who usually raid Palestinian areas, claiming they want to arrest Palestinians. During these confrontations, two Palestinians were wounded. They are brothers, 22-year-old and 21-year-old from the village of Beit Rima, also near the town of Kfar Ayn. Palestinian paramedics, the Ministry of Health, said that one of the brothers, a 22-year-old Jawad Abdel Jawad Al-Rimawi, was shot and killed. His brother was seriously wounded and transferred to hospital. It's not clear how his health situation is right now, because first we received that the two brothers were killed, and now it's not clear whether both the brothers had been killed or at least one, and the second is in serious condition. This is what happened this morning in the village of Kfar Ayn. What happened earlier in Al-Khalil, also known as Hebron, Israeli troops raided the town of Beit Umar. Clashes took place also between the Palestinian residents of that town and Israeli forces, killing at least the Israeli troops killed at least one Palestinian, Mufid Khalil, 44-year-old. 22 Palestinians were also wounded during these clashes. 9 of them were shot by live rounds. This is not the only thing. Following the clashes, paramedics transferred the wounded to a nearby clinic. The Israeli troops raided the clinic and also attacked the doctor and arrested him for offering help and treating the injured Palestinians.
Thank you very much. That was our correspondent, Mona Kandel, from Ramallah. Moving on, November 28th marks the third anniversary of a U.S. deadly drone strike on a civilian car in Afghanistan that killed all 5 people on board, including 3 women. Hamatullah Baghban reports.
Back on November 28th, 2019, an American drone strike hit a car returning from a maternity hospital in southeastern Afghanistan. The attack left 5 people dead, including a woman who had just given birth, 3 of her relatives, and the driver. The Afghan people, especially the relatives of victims, remembered the U.S. drone strikes as terrifying and unforgivable.
The targeted people were members of my uncle's family. They were martyred cruelly and horrifically. After giving birth to her son, my aunt's situation worsened. Then they left for the hospital together with my cousins. When returning from the hospital, their car was bombed by a U.S. drone strike. In total, 3 women, a boy called Noura Jan, and the driver, Mohammed Nabi, were martyred.
The U.S. crimes in Afghanistan are unforgivable. In fact, the U.S. government supported and empowered terrorists on our land and hurt civilians and innocent people. Now, as facts are surfacing, we understand that the U.S. war on terror was a game and a pretext to justify America's presence in the region.
Human rights advocates stress that such attacks show the reality of the U.S. war on Afghanistan. They criticize the failure of the U.S. to account for civilian victims of its airstrikes.
We have proof that the U.S. and its allies committed war crimes in Afghanistan. During their night raids, mass bombardments, and land missions, many innocent people were killed and their properties were damaged. The 2019 U.S. drone attack in Khost is one of many instances. Today, the families of victims are calling for investigations into such unlawful killings and compensation for their losses.
According to verified reports, throughout the 2-decade U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, over 13,000 airstrikes were conducted by American forces in the country. The U.S. drone war on Afghanistan killed up to 10,000 people, including many women and children. Afghan people are still suffering from the wounds inflicted by the U.S. occupation of their country. They call for justice for American forces' atrocities on their soil. Rahmatullah Baghban, Kabul.
Moving now to China, where calm is restored after a weekend of protests against restrictive COVID policies. The capital, Beijing, and Shanghai people are back to the daily routine of mass testing for the coronavirus. That is part of China's zero COVID strategy to contain the virus that has infected hundreds of people in the cities over the past days. Amid lockdowns imposed under the policy, some Chinese cities have witnessed street protests against the restrictions. The rallies were reportedly fueled by a fire at a building in the Xinjiang region. It is said that a lockdown in the area impeded the rescue efforts and led to the death of some of the residents. The government, however, has rejected any link between the protests and the incident. The Ukrainian president has warned his countrymen to prepare for more Russian attacks on infrastructure, saying that the raids will not stop until Moscow runs out of missiles. Volodymyr Zelensky says he expects the attacks this week to be as bad as last week's. He was referring to recent Russian missile strikes targeting Ukraine's energy infrastructure. Last week's barrage was the worst yet, leaving millions of people without electricity and water supplies. NATO, which has been a key ally of Ukraine in the war, has also predicted more attacks on Ukraine's power grid and infrastructure.
President Putin is now trying to use a weapon, use the winter as a weapon of war against Ukraine. And this is horrific, and we need to be prepared for more attacks. That's the reason why NATO allies have stepped up their support to Ukraine.
Stoltenberg was speaking ahead of a meeting of NATO's foreign ministers in Bucharest on Tuesday and Wednesday. The NATO chief said that supplying Ukraine with air defense systems is likely to be high on the agenda. He added that the ministers would also discuss providing spare parts, training, and ammunition to Kiev. Ukrainian authorities say the Russian missile attacks are aimed at harming civilians and amount to a war crime. Moscow has acknowledged the attack, saying it seeks to reduce Ukraine's ability to fight and push to negotiate. It has denied targeting civilians. The United States is on an annual pace to have their second highest number of mass shootings ever. The debate on gun control continues to be highly polarized, but many point to other causes such as poverty, inequality, and governmental indifference. Ramin Mazahiri has more.
In the United States, many spent their Thanksgiving holiday not in gratitude, but in grief, as mass shootings and violent crime continue to plague the nation. Many are lost in confusion, trying to explain why there have been over 600 mass shootings so far this year, a pace just below the all-time record. In only Chicago, the nation's third-largest city, 8 people were killed and at least 30 wounded by gun violence over the holiday weekend.
Everybody's always talking about how dangerous the city is, how unreasonable it is to live in America because of how much crime there is. Crime rates are actually about the same. What changes is how much funding are we getting? How many schools are closing? How many resources do people have? And when you actually don't actually invest in this with a growing population, that's of course going to cause more crime.
The Democratic Party is about to hand over control of the House of Representatives, and they are being widely criticized for refusing to pass stricter gun laws when they had the chance. Republicans are likely to defend gun ownership, and they eked out a midterm legislative victory with a major emphasis on violent crime.
No matter what grievances you bring up, no matter what facts you throw at any congressperson, Democratic or Republican, right? Their idea is to fund the police more. But this is money that should be going to the public. This is like, for example, here in Chicago, in 2020, the mayor asked the public, like, hey, how would you like to sort the budget out? And 80% of the people voted that, hey, we should defund the police and put that money back into other things that could really help out the community.
Crime data in the United States is often late or unreported. But what is certain is that since the coronavirus lockdowns, murders have increased by at least 30%. But what statistics cannot capture is the widespread sentiment that the violence in today's United States is more brutal, shocking, and random than it was in years past. While the U.S. is by far the most armed nation per capita, other countries have high rates of gun ownership, but not the regular violence which makes American life uniquely precarious and fearful. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
In Somalia, security forces have ended a deadly siege of a popular hotel in the capital, Mogadishu. A national police spokesman said Al-Shabaab militants stormed the hotel overnight, killing 8 civilians. He added that 60 civilians were rescued. One member of the security forces was also killed, while all 6 attackers are dead. Al-Shabaab claimed responsibility for the attack. The Al-Qaeda-linked militant group has been trying to overthrow Somalia's central government for 15 years. The country's recently elected government has been pursuing a policy of all-out war against Al-Shabaab. The militants have turned the attacks against civilians and military targets. That brings us to the end of this edition of World News.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program. please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The Supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging, and to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it, and leave no grief unless Thou takes it away, and leave no enemy, and leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of In the Name of Allah, the Best of the Names. In the Name of Allah, Lord of Earth and Heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is His anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is His good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from Thee, O Patron of Beneficence.
In the limelight.
The U.S. is last on a ranking of healthcare systems among 11 of the wealthiest countries in the world. Meanwhile, a new study reveals that this country ranks last among peer nations for COVID-19 mortality. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites for further details. Stay tuned for more. The United States ranks dismally among its peer nations when it comes to deaths from COVID-19. Dismal might not be a strong enough adjective, actually. The U.S. ranked dead last among its peer nations with the most deaths per capita. The data comes from a new study published in a medical journal, JAMA, which also analyzed the state-by-state vaccination and public health data. Alarmingly, researchers noted that if every state in the United States had the same vaccination rates as those states with the highest vaccination rates, more than 100,000 lives would have been saved. Led by researchers from the Brown University School of Public Health and the University of Pennsylvania Perelman School of Medicine, the JAMA study compared data on vaccinations and COVID-19 mortality in 2021 and 2022 between the United States and 20 other most populous countries in the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development, OECD. Not surprisingly, the per capita death rate was higher in America than any of those other 20 countries during the Delta and Omicron waves in 2021 and 2022, with America accumulating 370,298 COVID-19 fatalities in total. Yet the data was particularly illuminating when the authors compared the 10 U.S. states with the highest vaccination rates with those that had the lowest vaccination rates. According to a JAMA study, the per capita rate of COVID-19 death in the 10 states with the highest vaccination rates, 73%, was 75 deaths out of every 100,000 people. By contrast, the 10 states with the lowest rates of vaccination, 52%, had a per capita death rates of 146 out of 100,000 people. But on an international scale, the numbers looked bad too. The 10 most vaccinated states had an excess all-cause mortality rate that was equal to or less than that of several other OECD countries, including Denmark, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, Austria, and Finland. The phrase all-cause mortality rate refers to the total death rate based on all causes of death within a total population for a given period of time. That number is meaningful because many deaths that were on paper from other causes were indirectly caused by COVID-19. The authors of the study conclude from June 27, 2021 to March 26, 2022, the U.S. would have averted 122,304 deaths if COVID-19 mortality matched that of the 10 most vaccinated states and 266,700 deaths if U.S. excess all-cause mortality rate matched that of the 10 most vaccinated states. If the U.S. matched the rates of other peer countries, averted deaths would have been substantially higher in most cases, including range 154,622, 357,899 for COVID-19 mortality, 209,924, 465,747 for all-cause mortality. This means that if the 10 states which had the fewest number of vaccinated citizens had been inoculated at the rates of 10 states with the highest percentage of vaccinated citizens, roughly 122,000 people who died of COVID-19 during the 9-month period covered by the study would have lived instead. Similarly, if throughout the United States the total amount of excess deaths from all causes had been the same as in the 10 most highly vaccinated states, more than 266,000 deaths would have been avoided. The United States' dismal public health ratings owe a debt to the haze of vaccine misinformation that pervades the United States and which has become dogma among some right-wing politicians who have encouraged the spread of public health misinformation for political gain. Although anti-vaccine conspiracy theories became increasingly popular due to the COVID-19 pandemic, they long preceded it. In 1998, soon-to-be discredited Dr. Andrew Wakefield published a case series which claimed that the measles, mumps, and rubella vaccine, MMR vaccine, was linked to the development of autistic traits in young people. A panic ensued until it became clear that Wakefield's paper was riddled with problems. It had no data about MMR vaccine, included speculative conclusions, only reviewed a small sample of patients, and used a poorly designed experimental model. It later came out that Wakefield also had financial conflicts of interest, which he had not disclosed when publishing the study. Anti-vaccine ideas became more prevalent in 2020s after the COVID-19 pandemic reached the United States. Popular podcaster Joe Rogan touted supposed COVID-19 treatments that didn't work, such as horse dewormer in vermistin. Rogan's ideas spread thanks to other anti-vaccine celebrities. There is no scientific evidence indicating that purported COVID-19 treatments like hydroxychloroquine, ivermectin, vitamin C, and vitamin D are effective in stopping COVID-19 infections, while monoclonal antibodies can be effective, and Paxlovid works well. Both are second-line defenses that are much more likely to be given to the unvaccinated when they contract the virus, as unvaccinated persons typically have far worse outcomes if and when they contract COVID-19. According to Guardian, the U.S. is last on a ranking of healthcare systems among 11 of the wealthiest countries in the world, despite spending the highest percentage of its GDP on healthcare, according to a new report from the Commonwealth Fund. The country struggles with deep problems in affordability of healthcare, which affects access and equity, and it is the country that has the most administrative hurdles when dealing with the healthcare issue. This is despite the U.S. spending 17% of its gross domestic product on healthcare, far above the other 10 countries, according to the report. The other countries analyzed in the report were Australia, Canada, France, Germany, the Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Switzerland, and the UK. The ranking is based on 71 measures across five areas: access to care, care process, administrative efficiency, equity, and healthcare outcomes. The report notes that unlike the other countries in the study, the U.S. does not provide universal healthcare coverage. Americans are more likely to have problems paying medical bills and have their insurance denied. A larger percentage of Americans say they spend a lot of time on paperwork for medical bills, and doctors report having more trouble prescribing medication for patients because of restrictive health insurance coverage. The report notes that unlike the other countries in this study, the U.S. does not provide universal healthcare coverage. Americans are more likely to have problems paying medical bills and have their insurance denied. Americans also deal with lackluster access to care, with more American adults going to the emergency room for non-emergency care. Doctors of top-performing countries are usually readily available by phone or on night and weekend. The U.S. also has the largest disparity in care among income groups. We have almost two healthcare systems in America. one for people with means and insurance, and another one that falls short for people who are uninsured or don't have adequate insurance coverage. Eric Schinder, the lead author of the report and senior vice president for policy and research at the Commonwealth Fund, told Washington Post. Health statistics reflect the reality of having the worst healthcare system on the list. The U.S. has the highest infant, maternal, and avoidable mortality rates. The country also has less support for early childhood education and support systems, like unemployment protection for workers, leading to poorer health outcomes.
IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Palestine Declassified.
Hello, I'm Chris Williamson, and this is Palestine Declassified, where we investigate the Israeli regime's global war against solidarity with the illegally occupied people of Palestine. In today's programme, we'll be exploring how Google, the world's largest tech firm, is being integrated into the military of the Zionist entity. Google signed a contract known as Project Nimbus that will have extremely negative consequences for the Palestinian people. I'll be talking to experts about the implications of this development after this special report by Lutifa Abu-Chakra into the background to Project Nimbus and the resistance to it.
A scandal has erupted at US tech behemoth Google following a rebellion of workers against the company's integration with the Israeli military. This absorption of Google into Israel's arsenal of tools has developed in several ways. The climax of this integration is the bonding of Google and Amazon with the Israeli military through Project Nimbus.
So Project Nimbus is a $1.2 billion contract between Google and Amazon and the Israeli military and government. It was launched last year during May of 2021, right after the siege on Gaza, during which over 250 Palestinian people were killed at the hands of Israeli military violence. And the contract is actually providing tools to the Israeli government and military that will help the government and military scale out a multitude of forms of violence, including surveillance, data collection, the expansion of illegal settlement expansion. You know, there are a lot of different forms of violence that Google is essentially aiding and abetting through Project Nimbus.
The $1.2 billion contract is to construct at least 6 data centers, employing 500 Israelis at each site. The project will also provide cloud infrastructure to Israeli government institutions, including Israel's military and Israel Land Authority, which is the agency responsible for stealing Palestinian land and allocating it for Zionist colonies. It has been revealed that, through Nimbus, Google will supply very advanced artificial intelligence mechanisms to the Israeli military. Nimbus training documents, which were exposed by The Intercept, found that Google's Cloud Vision API would empower Israeli's facial recognition mechanisms. It has also been confirmed that Nimbus will be able to process data for lie detection purposes. An interesting twist in the Project Nimbus contract is that it contains an anti-BDS clause. The companies are barred from withdrawing the services from any institution. This would have certainly been inserted to enforce integration with the Israeli military, regardless of how horrific its crimes are against the Palestinians. So Google and Amazon will not have the power to stop their technology from being used for human rights violations, if they so wish. Despite the humiliating conditions of this agreement, Google's spokeswoman, Shannon Newbury, still gushingly boasted, "We are proud that Google Cloud has been selected by the Israeli government to provide public cloud services to help digitally transform the country. But almost 40,000 members of the public and 1,000 Google employees have signed a petition calling for the tech giant to pull out of the contract. And some workers are already resigning from their positions in protest. This full integration of the world's largest tech company with the Israeli military is only a matter of time. But the resistance still burns."
As always, we're joined by our resident expert, David Miller. David's an academic and former professor at Bristol University and a leading British scholarly critic of Israel. He's also the co-founder and co-director of the lobbying watchdog, Spinwatch. Our guest expert today is Huda Amori. As a founder of Palestine Action, Huda has led an unprecedented insurgency against Israel in the UK. She succeeded in shutting down two sites in England belonging to the Israeli weapons company, Elbit Systems. And in coordination with the local community in Oldham, she helped to force Elbit Systems to sell a subsidiary in the town. And Huda joins us today via Skype. Welcome to the show. David, let me start with you. What do you know about this Project Nimbus?
Well, this is a huge contract which Google have signed with the Israeli government and which affects the military as well as other oppressive ministries and agencies in the Zionist entity. And it allows quite extraordinary capacities for the IDF, for Israeli intelligence agencies, for crowd control, for surveillance, for facial recognition, for lie detection. Of course, these will be used straightforwardly in brutality and human rights abuses, and indeed, of course, in the torture, which the IDF is well known for in the territories and indeed in 48 Israel itself. So this is a kind of an agreement which allows Google to help the abuses carried out day and daily by the State of Israel.
I mean, Huda, I assume you would agree with that, but tell me from your perspective, and what do you think this means for the Palestinian people?
Well, I think it's important to acknowledge that tech companies are now becoming more powerful than many governments. And when those tech companies work with the Israeli military, they're essentially aiding in all of the violations against human rights and the colonization of the Palestinian people. Now, practically, that means on the ground encouraging the further blockade of the people of Gaza, the siege that has been routinely put on them, the blockade that has lasted over 15 years, and the constant military attacks, of which often Israel uses as an opportunity to test and improve the weapons that they use to then use against other people across the world. We know that Israel has already used surveillance cameras, as I've already mentioned, to blackmail Palestinians because they are so advanced in that arena. And this project is going to further add to that. But I think at the end of the day, when there are companies that many of us are forced into using, you know, it's often not a choice whether you use Google or Amazon because so many third-party platforms use them. It means that the weight and the size of the oppressors working against the Palestinians continues to increase. And as a result, we also have to increase our power, our grassroots power against them.
And Huda, can you tell us something about the apparent anti-BDS clause in the Project Nimbus contract?
Yeah, I mean, I think when you look at what BDS stands for, which is boycott, divestment and sanctions against the Israeli government to pressure them into complying with free demands, which include ending the colonization and occupation of Palestinian territories, including lifting the blockade of Gaza, for Palestinian refugees to have the right to return to their homes, which they were forced out of by Israel, and for Palestinian citizens to have equal rights as their Jewish counterparts. To have an anti-BDS clause is to go against those demands which are enshrined under international law and the human rights conventions, and is to further perpetuate an apartheid system. But basically, by doing this, and by working with the Israeli military and government in the first place, Google and Amazon have basically called themselves advocates for apartheid and worse, against the Palestinian people.
David, what do you know about Ariel Curran, who resigned from Google over Project Nimbus?
Well, she was one of the people who objected to this activity. And there were quite a number. You saw 1,000 people there signed that letter. Quite a number of Jewish employees signed a separate letter complaining about the contract. And they've raised the issue of human rights abuses in all the ways that you would imagine. Of course, what happened was that these people were either sacked or were all resigned. And so there's been a huge clear out there of people who would have any kind of critical view on the contract. And of course, inside Google itself, there are a number of others who are very supportive of this contract, but partly for business reasons, one would guess, but also partly there are those in there who are ideologically supportive of the Israeli government. And that's a significant problem for Google as a corporation.
No, indeed. I mean, and Huda, what kind of treatments has Palestine Action received from tech companies?
Well, from the start of Palestine Action, it became very clear that not only were we fighting a battle against Elbit, but we also had to find new ways to actually be able to get our words and our message out there, which was against an Israeli arms company. Within a month or two, Facebook had removed us after we were rapidly growing to 20,000 followers within a month or two. That followed by PayPal, DonorBox, Open Collective, many more liberal platforms as well removed us. And in the end, I think it's about 10 different tech companies and third-party platforms have removed Palestine Action or outright told us that we cannot use their platforms. And we actually discovered, I think after the seventh platform removed us, that it was because Elbit's lawyers were writing to them directly and that they were scared of a lawsuit and they were scared of going bankrupt. So basically, Elbit Systems, Israel's largest arms firm, were blackmailing, using legal warfare to blackmail companies into removing any support for our movement. But it has consistently failed to do so. And actually, the fact that they are forced into spending so much money on these lawyers to do so, I think is a testament the success of Palestine Action.
You know, David, the tech aspect of Israel's activities doesn't really get the attention it deserves, does it? I mean, how can that be combated?
Well, these are difficult stories to explain to people, I think. I mean, people understand human rights abuses. They understand direct support for human rights abuses from Zionist organizations and their activities in this country, in the US, for example. But trying to understand the technicalities of tech, if you like, of Google, of Amazon, of Twitter, is difficult for people. And also, they don't see the inside of these companies. So the fact that there are huge numbers of people who are from Israeli intelligence organizations inside the social media companies, people don't get that, they don't understand that, they don't know about that. So I think partly the question is how you explain this story to people, how you explain the strategy which is being used by the State of Israel to penetrate tech companies so that they will be supportive of the human rights abuses conducted by the State of Israel. So that's the key question, it seems to me, is to how you explain to people how tech is a useful and interesting way to look at the abuses caused by the State of Israel.
Yeah, and say a little bit about this Unit 8200, which people will have heard about, I'm sure, but may not be totally familiar with what it is. Can you just give a little bit of background briefly before
so, 8200 is an Israeli intelligence organization. So people will be familiar with Mossad, which is like the equivalent of the CIA or MI6 in the UK. But Unit 8200 is like the GCHQ, is the signals intelligence, it's a surveillance intelligence organization. It's part of military intelligence, it's part of the IDF. And they are engaged in the huge amount of surveillance there is of Palestinians. What we've been talking about just now, the attempt to surveil Palestinians, to spy on them, to to gather compromise on them, to gather information about which can be used to blackmail them, to stop them joining the resistance or to make them informers. There's a huge amount of activity there. And these people are leaving this organization and going into something like Google or Twitter. And that's really quite scary.
No, indeed. I mean, interesting, of course. Sir Keir Starmer appointed a former H200 operative to head up the Labour Party's social media activities. But we'll just have to pause there for a moment to have this report on how Israel lobby groups and former Zionist intelligence operatives are active in relation to Google.
Google's integration with the Israel military has been a steady development in which several key Israeli lobby groups have played an active role. Firstly, a group of employees within Google, which calls itself the Juglers, has been accused of driving right-wing ideologies and actively surveilling Arab and Muslim employees. The group successfully forced Google management to apologize for a donation it gave to the Movement for Black Lives Coalition on the basis that groups within the coalition had stated their solidarity with Palestinians. Another key entanglement Google has had with Israeli intelligence came with the founding of a tech hub by the name Team8. The CEO and co-founder is Nadav Zafrir, former commander of the infamous Signals Intelligence Unit 8200 in the Israeli military. Team8 was co-founded with Eric Schmidt, who at the time was executive chairman of Google.
Believe it or not, in all the years that I've worked with Israeli companies, this is my first physical visit here.
Really?
And I now understand why everybody was so excited about the country. Yeah. You know, it really is startup nation.
Yeah.
And for the stuff that I do, it's like the perfect positive storm.
Yeah.
You know, the sum of the educational system, the way the military works.
It's the curse into the blessing.
Well, no, but it's you may not appreciate how significant an advantage it gives you because you're used to it, right? You live it, but it's notably different from any other country, and you really feel it.
Israel lobby group, the Anti-Defamation League, is a select contributing member of YouTube's Trusted Flagger program, meaning that Google allows it to regulate content on the most used video service in the world. In a declassified FBI memo from 1969, it is questioned if the ADL, quote, represents a violation of the Foreign Agents Registration Act due to the, quote, extreme close ties between the ADL and Israel. Google is also a member of the ADL Silicon Valley Anti-Cyber Hate Working Group. Another part of this integration has been the Startup Nation Central Organization set up by Republican donor Pauli Singer. The stated purpose of the organization is to combat BDS by feeding big tech jobs into Israel, but also by feeding Israeli workers into big tech companies. It's through organizations like Startup Nation Central that you have huge mass of former Israeli intelligence agents working inside Google today. A Mint Press investigation found there are at least 99 former Israeli Intelligence Unit 8200 personnel currently working inside Google, many of them working in very sensitive positions in the company. No doubt the Juglers lobby group will include them amongst their number. Some include Gavriel Gordel, who from 2010 to 2016 worked in Unit 8200, analyzing intelligence data to understand patterns of hostile activists. Today, he's the head of strategy and operations at Google. Jonathan Cohen was a team leader at Unit 8200, and is today the head of insights, data, and measurement at Google. The list is long and dangerous. Today, Google stands as a technological weapon against Palestinian liberation.
David, what do you make of the tactics of this Juglers group within Google then?
Well, it seems to be a kind of unofficial Zionist lobby group, doesn't it? And of course, as a speculation in the film there, presumably many of the people who are in or who were in Unit 8200, the Israeli intelligence organization, are part of the Juglers group. And they've been, you know, they attacked and have been involved in the surveillance of Muslim employees of Google. But also, the key thing was the return of this donation to Black Lives Matter Foundation, which is a truly extraordinary thing. It's part of this whole idea that is promoted by the ADL, who we saw in the film there, and indeed by similar lobby groups in the UK, like the Community Security Trust, the idea that it's only racism against the Jews which is important, that that's the most important form of racism in the society, and we must not engage with groups like BLM in case they have, for example, supporters of Palestine amongst their supporters, which of course they do. So it's an attempt really to focus all attention of liberals on anti-Semitism as the preeminent form of racism in the society, and to make sure we don't talk about anti-black racism and certainly not about anti-Palestinian racism.
I mean, Huda, organisations like Team 8 and Stand Up Nation Central seem to be combating BDS by feeding figures from the Israeli Intelligence Corps, Unit H200, into big tech companies. So, yet these outfits are relatively anonymous to most people. I mean, why do you think that is?
Well, I think it's almost slightly similar to Elbit, in the sense that these companies don't necessarily want the attention, and they shouldn't want the attention because they are aware that if people were completely exposed to it, it would be widely condemned and it wouldn't be allowed to happen in the first place. And so often you find that these companies stray away from public attention and operate more in the shadows, because by placing Unit 8200 officers into companies like Google is essentially infiltrating spaces which harvest a lot of data. You know, these are power hubs for data collection, which there have been many scandals in the past. But now it means that our data, my data, or anyone else's data who works for the Palestinian people is exposed to people who have and may continue to work on behalf of the Israeli government in order to perpetuate its oppression against the Palestinian people. And obviously, this is not something which you would know when you use Google, because it's so widely known, or Amazon. And that's what makes it a dangerous and effective strategy that the Israeli military or these companies are trying to use in order to gain access to that data without people's knowledge.
David, the Anti-Defamation League, I mean, tell us a little bit about its history and why is its relationship with YouTube a cause for concern?
Well, the ADL, the Anti-Defamation League, has been in existence for over a century now, and it started up as a branch of the B'nai B'rith, one of the key international Zionist organisations. And from very, very early on, in fact, from the 1940s, from before the creation of the State of Israel, it's been engaged in spying on Arab Americans and attempting to work with the FBI to harass them and to convict them for crimes. So it's been doing this since the 1940s, and indeed in the 80s and 90s, there were court cases against it where it was revealed that it had been spying on thousands and thousands of activists, left-wing and liberal activists, including anti-apartheid activists in the case of South Africa, and it was actually selling data that it had collected from its spying operations directly to the apartheid regime in South Africa. So this is an organization which is effectively an implement, an instrument against the left, which poses as being an anti-racist organization. Mm. And it's very similar in a way to the Community Security Trust in the UK, which does similar stuff here, spies on the left. Indeed. Now, it's worrying because they pose as liberals, they have access to, you said, YouTube, but also to the Twitter safety panel and to many other social media companies' safety panels. So, and this is the case not just with the ADL in the US, but with the CST in the UK, with Le Crif in France. The Zionist organizations are able to moderate and help to moderate content on social media companies in a way that no Muslim organization, and certainly no Palestinian organization, is able to do. So there's a fundamental imbalance here, even if we leave out of account the former intelligence operatives who work inside the companies. We have Zionist organizations helping them to take decisions.
Mm. I mean, Huda, organizations like Team 8 and Startup Nation Central seem to be combating BDS by feeding figures from the Israeli Intelligence Corps, Unit 8200, into big tech companies. Yet these outfits are relatively anonymous to most people. I mean, why do you think that is?
It's disgusting, and I think the timescale says a lot that this happened. Their promotion happened after the Project Nimbus had started. He became head of strategy in October 2022. And I mean, I think in general, the fact that anyone had a job for harvesting data and hostile activists is a bit of a strange term to use in the first place, but it shows that, and I think Ariel, a former Google worker, has said this, that in the past few years, it's become clear from inside Google that there is an institutional Zionist bias. And I don't think it's a coincidence that many of these former UNIT 1800 officers have been entering Google in those few years at the same time. So I think we're seeing a steady increase in the fact that Google is going to be used as another tool for the Zionist project. And in all, Israel has created an economy based on the domination of the Palestinian people. And I think what we're seeing here in general is these companies are trying to cash in on that colonization and oppression of the Palestinian people. And as long as we allow that to continue, we're going to see more and more powerful big tech companies, which normal people across the world are using day to day, also cashing in on that oppression.
David, I mean, what would you say the significance of this chap, Eric Schmidt's relationship is with Israel?
Well, I mean, you saw a little bit of the clip there with him with Benjamin Netanyahu from some years ago. And if you've watched the whole clip, it's really quite vomit-inducing, this obsequiousness. And I mean, saying to Netanyahu, I'm not sure you realise, Benjamin, just how fantastic your country is. And specifically mentioning the military, you know, nobody in the world who's ever had any attention to the media would be unaware of the horrific war crimes committed by the IDF day and daily, and the ongoing abuses that we see on television news every night. Even on the mainstream news, we see these things, never mind on alternative sources. So that's a significant issue. Now, I mean, he was this the question of what he said there, but also, of course, as shown.